Okay. Thank you very much. So first of all, let me thank the organizers of this workshop and the whole program for having me here. It's a pleasure to be in Canada again. So in my talk, I'm going to discuss some geometric properties of random matrices with independent log-concave rows or columns, depending on a given problem. And it will be a survey of results obtained within the last 2 years with a number of people. So we have Olivier Guédon, Sasha Litvak, Alain Pajor, and Nicole Tomczak-Jegerman. So let me start with some basic definitions, which most of you know very well, but just to fix the setting. So a random vector in Rn will be called isotropic if it's of mean zero, and its covariance matrix is the identity. So this latter condition can be equivalently stated in the following form as this quality. So what does it tell you? Simply that the second moment of linear functionals are equal to the second moment, to the square of the Euclidean norm. So it justifies the name isotropic because it depends only on the norm and in the right way. So these are isotropic vectors, and another definition I'm going to use is the notion of psi alpha vector. Well, just for alpha between 1 and 2, which is natural in the context of log-concave vectors. So a vector is psi alpha if now the psi alpha Orlich norm of a linear functional applied to a vector is bounded by the Euclidean norm of this vector y. So just to recall that the psi alpha norm is defined by the following formula, and it actually appeared in some of yesterday's talks. Be familiar. Just a few basic consequences. So if a vector is isotropic, a straightforward calculation shows that the second moment of the Euclidean norm is n. So in the mean square sense, the Euclidean norm is of the order square root of n. Later on, I will impose conditions which will assure that it holds also with high probability. And just by Chebyshev inequality, the linear functionals exhibit a sub-exponential tail decay, and it depends on the alpha in this psi-alpha definition. For alpha equal to 2, it's sub-Gaussian, and for alpha equal to 1, it's sub-exponential. One remark, just basic linear algebra. So whenever you have a non-degenerate random vector, by non-degenerate, I mean a one that is not supported on a proper hyperplane, we can put it in an isotropic position with an affine map. So what do you do? Obviously, you first shift it to make it centered, and then you look at the eigenvalues and eigenvalues of the covariance matrix, and you rotate and expand in proper directions. And one more remark. So for a set in Rn, well, we will call a set isotropic if the random vector distributed uniformly on K is isotropic. So this differs from the definition used by geometers. We will not assume that it's of volume 1. In fact, it will not be of volume 1. Just the covariance matrix being identity. So it's more probabilistic than geometric normalization. And now log concavity, which appeared already in Emmanuel's talk yesterday. So the standard definition is, of course, via this Brun-Minkowski inequality, but for us, we'll be dealing with non-degenerate vectors, so it's more convenient to use Borel's characterization. So a non-degenerate vector is log-concave simply if it has density which is log-concave. So this density can vanish, this V can take value infinity. And another classical result by Borel tells us that isotropic log-concave vectors are always psi 1 with universal constants. So we will use it later. Just examples, which again all of you know. So Gaussian measures on the one hand to have something interesting from the probabilistic point of view, like classical uniform distributions on convex bodies, which is more geometric. And of course, like knowing this Borel's characterization, you can produce a lot of such measures. What is nice is that this class is closed under basic operations, which like products, affine images, convolutions, and so on. Okay, so finally, I can define the basic model we are going to discuss. So throughout the whole talk, gamma will be a little n by capital N random matrix with independent isotropic log concave columns. So x1 up to xn, capital N will be those columns, and it's no coincidence that we have little n and capital N. Most of the time, capital N will be larger than the little n. So what kind of questions I'm going to discuss? So these are mostly the questions which are counterparts of classical problems in classical results known for Gaussian vectors or random matrices with independent coefficients. So what is the operator norm of gamma acting between the Euclidean spaces? When gamma transpose is close to a multiple of isometry, in a moment I will explain why we are looking at gamma transpose. Well, how does gamma transpose act on sparse vectors? What are the extreme singular values? And a question of different flavor, if I have time, more related to classical theory of random matrices, what is the distribution of singular values or eigenvalues of gamma? Okay, so let me start with the second question about gamma transpose acting on the sphere and when it is close to a multiple of isometry. So let me give some motivation. It is a problem that appeared in mid-90s. It was introduced by Kanan, Lovas, and Szymonowicz. So imagine you have a convex body in Rn. Well, assume that you have some bounds. You know that it contains the unit Euclidean ball and is contained in some multiple. And well, this problem comes from computer science, so well, many of you know this problem, sure. So imagine that this body is given by an oracle. We don't know how it is constructed, we just know that it answers questions of the type, well, does X belong to K for any X in Rn? And it will tell us yes or no. So in this model of computational model of convex sets, well, the question posed by them, I mean Kanan, Lovas, and Szymonowicz, was how to generate random points uniformly distributed in K and how to compute the volume of K. So it is standard in computer science or Markov chain Monte Carlo method that if you know how to answer the first question for all K, or at least a reasonably large class, then you can reduce the second question to the first one. And well, the reduction is quite standard and simple. And of course, the first question is usually answered by Markov chain. So the idea is to construct a Markov chain which can be easily simulated on a computer, run it for some time. We want this Markov chain to have the uniform distribution as the stationary measure. And after running, simulating the chain for a number of steps, we stop and we hope that the random output that we obtain is uniformly distributed, roughly uniformly. So the analysis of the speed of convergence of such chains is a completely different theory connected with isoperimetry and what Emmanuel was speaking about yesterday. So that's why he also mentioned Kanan, Lovas, and Szymonowicz. What is important for this presentation is that the speed of convergence depends on the position of the body and on some geometric parameters. And it turns out that the isotropic position is good to start your sampling. So the idea in some algorithms for computing the volume, for example, is to put K in the isotropic position first. So how do you do it? Well, you have to shift, rotate, and rescale. So you have to know the mean and the covariance matrix. Of course, those you approximate with random samples as well. And now it looks like going in circles because we need random samples to put K in isotropic position, and well, we want to do it in the first place to get random samples. But well, people in computer science are quite smart, so they figured out how to do it, somehow intertwine this procedure, so everything is stable here. So you can sample a little bit, then move your body to a better position, sample a little bit, and so on. So from the point of view of computing the complexity of the algorithm, right, important problem is how to compute approximately the mean and the covariance matrix of a vector uniformly distributed in a convex body, assuming that we have access to independent samples perfectly distributed uniformly on this body. So, of course, we do it with the law of large numbers. And, well, centering the body, that is finding the mean, is computationally easy. It's linear in the dimension, the number of samples that you need. And this is a consequence of quantitative version of the law of large numbers for log concave vectors obtained by Gigon-Shachtman. So for us, the question reduces to how to approximate the covariance matrix with this sample covariance matrix. How large should capital N be to have good approximation? So you may notice that, well, I already assumed that the vector is centered simply because we already know that we can center the vector. And it's not an unbiased estimator, but well, we don't care about this. It's just the scaling. So the error we are interested in is the relative error in the operator norm. And that's why when you look at it just for a little bit, you will easily see that if it's the relative error, you can equivalently transform everything to the isotropic position. So the real question is, given an isotropic convex body, how many samples do we need to have this sample covariance matrix close to epsilon close to identity in the operator norm? Okay, and well, this is just exploring the definition of a norm, or not the definition, but writing down what a norm of a symmetric matrix is. When you write it down, you will see that this thing that we want to be small is actually equal to this side. So the geometric question, in fact, is, well, if we have, now we have gamma transpose. Recall that gamma was a matrix with independent columns. So now gamma transpose is a matrix with independent rows. And we have a matrix with independent log concave isotropic rows. And the question is how large should n be so that after appropriate normalization, the standard normalization here, the matrix is an almost, well, maybe I should say, an almost isometric embedding of a little n to capital N. And this is obviously a question that for Gaussian matrices was investigated classically in the asymptotic geometric analysis. So there is a connection here. Okay, just a few words about the history of the problem. So as I said, it started with Kanan, Lovas, and Szymanowicz. And they proved using the analysis of variances that capital N, it's enough to take capital N quadratic in the dimension. And it was actually enough for their purposes. Those algorithms are, I think theirs was of the order N to the power 6. Later it was reduced, I think, to the power 4. I'm not sure at the moment. Anyway, it was enough for them. And well, if you just want to have polynomial complexity, it is enough. But this question, well, this was an interesting question, like between, with some geometric and probabilistic flavor, so it attracted attention of many people, and in particular, quite soon Bourgain proved that it's almost linear. And from then, people started removing those logarithms. So maybe it's important to mention here Mark Rudelson's approach, who, well, Mark proposed a very general method, which turned out to be very useful in computer science and discrete mathematics. However, it was known from the very beginning, because of the generality of the method, that it could not give the conjecture O of N bound in this convex case. Simply the logarithm was there from the very beginning, and you cannot avoid it because of the discrete counterexamples, and the method is very general. So later, Greek teams obtained the best possible result in this context, which you can get with Mark's approach. So first for unconditional bodies, and then Grigoris did it for, oh, it died, I guess, for the general case. In the meantime, Guillaume Obron solved the problem for unconditional bodies using moment methods from random matrix theory. And 2 years ago, we were able to settle the general case to show that for all convex bodies, or log-concave measures, you indeed need only linear sample of a linear size to get good approximation of the covariance matrix. Let me also mention a related research. So you cannot remove logarithms, as I said, if you don't impose some conditions, additional conditions on the linear functionals. And recently, Roman Vershinin proved something like n log log n under very weak assumptions, 4 plus epsilon. Please remember that log concave vectors are psi 1, so it's much stronger than they have all the moments, and the moments grow in a linear way. So you may think that, well, that from the point of view of the KLS question, this is the end of the story, but actually it is not, because quite recently we were able to get an improved estimate, which is important from some point of view, which I will explain in a moment. So now that the statement can be given, oh, it shouldn't be one, it should be identity, of course. So the sample capital N is greater than N, and then this L2 operator error is bounded by C times square root of little n divided by capital N. So why is it an improvement? Well, previously we had this multiplied by log capital N over N. So it was obviously still enough to get the good approximation with linear number of samples, but from the point of view of the dependence of an epsilon, it was suboptimal. And also this statement is interesting because of the Bayesian theorem in classical random matrix theorem. So theory, so it can be, this may be seen as a non-asymptotic counterpart of a limiting result, which holds true for random matrices with independent entries. And this is optimal. Always nice to have an optimal result. Okay, now I promise to tell you what was the connection between the KLS question and the first question I mentioned, the question of bounding the operator norm. Well, in one way it is obvious. If we know that this matrix is an almost isometry, then we know the bound on the operator norm. So it seems like this question is more, the KLS question is more difficult, at least for some range of capital N. At least they are related, and it turns out that actually you can go in the other direction. So if you have some more information on the operator norm, then you can use it to solve this KLS problem. And I'm not going to go into details here and say how you do this reduction, but I will show you what information you need. So what you are looking at is the sequence AM, which is, well, you have the definition here. It's the support of supremum of the Euclidean norm of gamma z over z from the unit sphere, but with support of size at most m, with at most m non-zero coefficients. So equivalently, it is the maximum operator norm among all matrices obtained from gamma by selecting m columns of gamma. Recall that gamma had capital N independent columns. So this is a random sequence which grows, obviously, with m. And the key to solve the KLS problem is the following theorem about the growth of this sequence. So it turns out that with high probability, the sequence grows like square root of n, which has to be there already for m equal to 1. Let's recall that, well, this is the Euclidean norm, roughly, of a single column, so it must be there. And with m, it grows like this. So in particular, if you plug in little m equal to capital N, this log will just become a constant, and you get the bound on the operator norm, which coincides up to constant with the bound in the Gaussian setting, which was another motivation. And how do you prove it? Well, obviously, I don't have time to go into the proof. Just let me say that you look at the support of an arbitrary vector, you cut it into pieces, and you approximate the each piece separately by vectors from some epsilon nets, which should be constructed in a proper way. So the larger the support of a particular piece, the smaller the L infinity norm of the vector with which you approximate. And you have to play with the number of, well, also the approximation error depends on this support. So you have to play with all of this, like the number of vectors with which you approximate, this balance between the L2 approximation and L infinity norm. And when you use the chaining, you arrive at an inequality like this. So now it's, pretty standard, like we have an inequality with an of both sides, but here in the power 2 and here with the power 1. So we can basically solve for an, just that we should know what this first term is. And here, fortunately, we can use the theorem celebrated with us by Grigoris Pauris, which tells you that, the Euclidean norm of a log concave isotropic vector is square root of n, not only in this mean square sense, but also with very high probability. So if capital N is not very large, there was an exponential bound on capital N in terms of little n, this first term is just n, and then you can simply solve it. Okay, so let me now pass to another question that was on the list. And let's go back first to this KLS problem again. So you see in this problem, in the formulation, there is no mention of sparse vectors, but it turns out that to analyze the problem, to solve it, you go through analysis of the way that gamma acts on sparse vectors. So these days, I guess if you think about sparse vectors, if you hear sparse vectors, you immediately think about compressed sensing. So, why not take a look whether those ideas could be explored in the compressed sensing context. So let me first give you a very brief explanation of what compressed sensing is. Again, probably all of you know it, so just very briefly. Imagine that we have a vector which lives in a very high dimensional space but has only few non-zero coordinates, so the support is of cardinality little n, and assume that we are allowed to take linear measurements of this vector. That is, we can learn values of linear functionals acting on this vector. So obviously, if we knew the support of x, it would be enough to measure x along coordinates that do not vanish, and the rest is zero, and it will identify the determine x. But the question is, what if we know that the support is small, but we don't know where it is located? So a priori, we still have to measure all coordinates, but now everyone knows that we can do much better. The answer was given by Donohoe, Canvas, Tao, and Tromberg, and just take measurements in random directions and among all vectors consistent with your measurements, pick up the one with the smallest L1 norm. And it turns out that under many models of randomness, it will recover the vector X exactly. So what is the connection with geometry? Let me recall the notion of M-neighborliness. So a polytope is called M-neighborly if any set of vertices of K of cardinality at most M plus 1 is exactly the vertex set of a face. So this is not what is relevant for compressed sensing, but a modification of this definition for the symmetric case is. So a centrally symmetric polytope is called M symmetric neighborly. Well, if the same holds, it's just that now obviously we have to assume that the set of vertices contains no opposite pair, because otherwise, obviously, it cannot span a face. So this notion of neighborliness was investigated by discrete geometers many years ago already, and it turned out to be connected with applied mathematics thanks to a theorem due to Donohoe. So let's imagine that we have a matrix gamma, which is, again, little n times capital N. So we will think of the rows of the matrix as the directions of our measurements. So little n is the number of measurements, and it's much smaller than the capital N. So these are the rows that we measure along, but we will look at the columns of the matrix here. And it turns out that measuring in directions of the rows of the matrix allows you to recover all the vectors of sparsity M via this L1 minimization method. This is called basis pursuit method. If and only if the polytope spanned, symmetric polytope spanned by the columns, so now we look at the columns instead of rows, has the maximum possible number of vertices and is M symmetric neighborly. So now you can use this result in both directions, like you can prove the neighborliness and get applications, or if for some reason you know that the first part holds, that it's a good sensing matrix, you can use it to analyze random polytopes. And in a sense, this is what we are going to do. So to this end, we will need another now sufficient condition for this L1 minimization method to work. So it was given by Candace and Tao, and it's more in the spirit of this KLS problem or embedding. So it turns out that, well, maybe I will show you. This L1 minimization works if the matrix acts as an almost isometry, this is what is written here really, on the set of all two M sparse vectors. Then you can recover all vectors of cardinality, of support of cardinality little m. So obviously, if the number of rows is small, it cannot act as an isometry on the whole sphere, but what we want here is that it acts as an isometry on a very special subset, small subset of the sphere. You need vectors with small support. And, well, via Donohoe's theorem, now we know that in consequence, if this restricted isometry property is satisfied, then the corresponding polytopes are M symmetric neighborly or M neighborly. So, again, some history. So, historically, the first results about RIP were proved for Gaussian and matrices with rows selected randomly from the Fourier matrix by Candace and Tao, and this latter case of the Fourier matrix was improved by Mark Rudelson and Roman Vershinin. This is the best known bound, I guess, at the moment. Then the first case was generalized by Mendelssohn, Pajor, Tomczak, Jägermann to sub-Gaussian isotropic rows. And so this is more relevant to sensing, compressed sensing, because to measurements, because you look at random independent rows. And a year ago, we generalized, not generalized, but we obtained this RIP property for independent log concave isotropic columns. So now it's more in the spirit of random polytopes, because these are columns that are independent. You may notice that this oversampling, which we have here, we have log square, and it was log in the Gaussian or sub-Gaussian case. It cannot be improved under our assumptions simply because of counterexamples, but it's just for this RIP property. When you look at the, it was just a sufficient condition for the polytope to be symmetric neighborly. So there is a conjecture that it should be, for the neighborliness, it should be m of the order r, n divided by log, not log square. And there is some numerical evidence. It was found by Donohoe and Tanner, which suggests that there is some universality, that under very general models of randomness, this neighborliness is most of the time n divided by log. But, well, we don't know how to prove in this concrete case. So this is just the result I mentioned before. This is just this restricted isometry property. Here I wrote it in a more general form. So if we assume that our vectors are isotropic log concave and additionally psi r, r between 1 and 2, then we have a better oversampling factor. In particular, it recovers the case of Gaussian matrices because then they are psi 2. So a general log concave measure is psi 1 only, so that's why in the corollary, we have neighborliness of the order n divided by log to the power 2. And how do you prove it? Well, again, it's just one slide. But roughly, you use the same or similar approximation techniques as for bounding this AM parameter in the KLS problem. It's now that just you look at this number BM, which can be seen in a, as, well, let's say, almost isometric counterpart of this AM. The difference is like this isomorphic estimates and almost isometric estimates. So the first thing here, sum Zi xi is just gamma applied to the vector z, which is of small support and norm 1. The second thing, well, it's just some expression coming from the proof. But now, if we can show that the second thing is with high probability equal to n for all sparse vectors, sparse unit vectors, then we are done. This is exactly the uniform uncertainty principle. And since Z has Euclidean norm 1, this weights here add up to 1. So it's enough to look at each vector separately. And fortunately, now we can use the epsilon concentration result by Klartak. So it tells you that indeed all those vectors will be with high probability of Euclidean norm close to square root of n. So this term is roughly n, and you get, after the normalization, you get the RIP. So again, this may be seen as an almost isometric version of the result by Pauris about the Euclidean norm of log concave vector. Okay, so now let me go back, one slide back, and let's take a look at, well, consider r equal to 1, so it's just log square, and let's take a look at a very special case where the matrix is square, so little n is equal to capital N. You may look here or here, like here it is, can be seen more easily. Well, this log disappears, like this is just a constant. So it turns out that the matrix satisfies RIP, it acts as an almost isometry on all sparse vectors with the support small, but small being still proportional to the size of the matrix, to the dimension. So if we knew that it acted like that on the whole sphere, then it would mean a bound on the smallest and the largest singular value of the matrix. But, well, it is well known that for random matrices, it is not the case. Square matrices do not act as an almost isometry. You have, you need a tall matrix. And there is this classical result from the 80s by Edelman and Szarek. Okay, so here it's just the notation, like to fix the notation, S1 will be the largest singular value, that is the operator norm, Sn the smallest singular value. And we know that the largest singular value in the IID, in the independent coefficient case, is square root of n. We know it also by what by this KLS approach, that this is the case in our setting. And for the Gaussian case, it was known that the smallest singular value in the square case is of the order 1 over square root of little n. So, and additionally, you have this, well, you can call it a small ball type inequality. So if you multiply by epsilon here, the probability will decay in this way. So a few years ago, I think like 6-7 years ago, Spielmann and Tank asked about the same problem for more general matrices with independent coefficients. And there were many papers about that. And well, the case of the square matrix was settled by Rudelson and Vershenin and also by Tao and Vu in a slightly different context. So under more general assumptions, well, this is just one of the results, but you have the same inequality, but up to some small epsilon. Like for epsilon really small, you have this correction term C to the n there, and you can see very easily that it has to be there simply because in the case of a random sign matrix, this is roughly the probability that two rows will coincide. So the matrix will be singular with this probability, and that's why you cannot go with epsilon all the way down to zero. So now we know that the matrix acts well on sparse vectors, and this was also an element of proof in this independent coefficients case. So now we may try to use those results, this knowledge from this RIP, to obtain a bound on the smallest singular value. And it was also obtained last year with these alphas. So the first inequality here may be seen a counterpart of this result. Well, we have a different term here just because we use Klartak's result, and this is exactly the probability that appears in Klartak's result. So you have to look at sparse vectors, which we already have, and then at vectors easily approximated by sparse, which we can do because we know a bound on the operator norm, and then at the non-compressible vectors, which cannot be approximated by sparse vectors. And for that, we use some lemma by Rudensel-Vershinin and use good analytic properties of log-concave vectors. So they have really nice densities, so you can play with it. But the fact that they have really nice densities means that this first inequality is not completely satisfactory, because the reason for this correction term here was purely discrete. So we have a very smooth setting. So when you worked a little bit harder, you can get something like that. Well, which is not C epsilon, which we'd like to have there, but as n becomes large, it approaches this power 1. Well, maybe this simpler corollary will be more digestible. So for each delta, we have a constant C delta. And obviously, the conjecture is that it should be just a universal constant times epsilon, but at the moment, we don't know how to prove. And historically, it was the smallest singular value was related to the condition number, which was important for numerical calculations. So here is the corollary. Again, the same story. We'd like to have it C over T. At the moment, we don't know. I think that the proof here should be perhaps more analytic, somehow exploring these good properties of the densities. So this was the smallest singular value. Now let me go back to the restricted isometry property again. So previously I showed it for independent columns, and I argued that it was natural from the geometric point of view when you look at random polytopes, but not so much from the point of view of measurements. So now I'd like to look at the case of independent rows, which is more natural from the point of view of measurements. Still, to be honest, for compressed sensing, it's not so important, because in compressed sensing, well, people choose the matrix once and they work with a fixed matrix. So what they really want to do is not to replace one randomness, for example, Gaussian randomness, with log-concave randomness, but rather to decrease the number of randomness, to de-randomize those constructions. But still, this RIP property turns out to be useful in statistics, in, for example, sparse regression problems. So some regression models with random design working well over the set of sparse vectors work at the best rate, approximation rate, if a condition related to RIP, implied by RIP, slightly weaker, is satisfied. So from the point of view of statistics, for example, or just out of curiosity, it makes sense to ask for RIP for matrices with independent log-concave rows. And for this class of matrices, we don't have the final result yet. We have to restrict to a smaller class, so let me recall that a random vector is unconditional if its distribution does not change whenever you plug in signs in front of the coefficients. So in other words, if the distribution does not change when you reflect with respect to coordinate hyperplanes. And for such vectors, we have this result. So it is the same, the statement is more or less the same as for independent columns. So if we have a random matrix of log-concave isotropic but now unconditional rows, then we have the same oversampling log square. We are not able to do this psi arc, psi alpha case, except for alpha equal to 2, when it is known by a result which I mentioned, by Schachar, Mendelssohn, Alan Pajor and Nicole Tomczak-Jegerman, that even log concavity is not needed. But if you have a log concave unconditional vector which is additionally psi alpha, we don't know how to use this psi alpha additionally. So, but for this generality, this is the optimal result. And let me just tell you how we use this unconditionality. Well, so the approach is by using a comparison principle for norms of such unconditional log concave vectors by Rafał Latała. So he's going to speak about it on Friday, I guess. And it's not just an application of this result, but on the way in the course of the proof, at some point we have to estimate some quantities and then some sort of decoupling replacing this comparison principle allows you to replace the unconditional log concave vector with a vector with independent coefficients. So then you can use the fact that concentration for such vectors is known in a stronger form, which is only conjectured for log concave unconditional vectors. Okay, so I guess I have like 4 minutes left. So let me just very briefly pass to the last question I mentioned at the beginning, and let us look at the spectral distribution of this matrix A. So it appeared in Elizabeth's talk yesterday. The spectral measure of the matrix is just the n by n matrix is just the normalized counting measure on the set of eigenvalues counted with multiplicity. So it just tells you what fraction of all eigenvalues falls into a given set. And one of the classical results for random matrices is the Marchenko-Pastor theorem, which tells you that if you have a random matrix with IID coefficients and the ratio between the number of rows and the number of columns converges to some number strictly between 0 and infinity, then the empirical distribution of this sample covariance matrix converges almost surely to a measure which is universal. It is non-random and depends only on y. So this is called the Marchenko-Pastor distribution with parameter y. The formulas for this are explicit, but they differ there are two cases for y larger and smaller than 1, so I'm not going to give it here. Anyway, 40 years after this result, Alain Pajor and again Leonid Pastor proved that the same holds for matrices with independent log-concave isotropic rows. Both results are more general. This is just the simplest form. There was also a contribution by Guillaume Obron, who handled the case of LP balls, vectors uniformly distributed on LP balls. The case of the Euclidean ball was known already to Marchenko and Pastor. So the result is the same. There is again this universality. And now, well, it tells you that random matrices with log-concave independent rows behaves again more or less like matrices with all coefficients independent. So this is this idea that log-concavity steps in for the independence, which is weaker. And another example which I would like to finish is again another classical theorem about random matrices with IID coefficients, so the circular law. If you just look at the spectral measure of AN, a matrix with IID coefficients, it is a measure, well, A is not symmetric, so the measure is a measure in the complex plane. It was proved, well, in this generality by Tao and Wu, but there were many contributions before, that it converges almost surely to the uniform measure on the unit disk. So, I can prove that the same holds for independent log-concave isotropic rows, and again I have to assume unconditionality, but well, this time it's not because of the same reason. The reason is purely random matrices. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much.